David, I recently learned about the Lind effect, the idea that the older something is, the longer it's likely to be around in the future. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I have. It comes from Nassim Taleb. I read it in his books.
Now, I found it really interesting because human life expectancy declines with age. But according to the Lind effect, for ideas, it's the opposite. The longer the idea, the brighter its future.
You know, there was one time where I was in New York, and this idea of the Lindy effect comes from a restaurant in New York City in Midtown Manhattan. And I went with some friends to go visit Lindy's restaurant. And the reason that it comes from that restaurant is this restaurant is like 10 blocks north of the Broadway section in New York by Times Square, where they host all the plays. And the reason that this idea came about was because actors used to go to Lindy's and they realized that the longer that a play had been active on Broadway, the longer it was expected to continue being around. So rather than a play being on Broadway for like 90 years and only having 10 years left, they said no, because it's been on for 90 years. Then the chance that it's going to be on for another 90 years is actually higher than a new play that just got released. And that's why you see plays like The Lion King, which I saw when I was a kid, that continue to stick around. But the Lindy effect isn't always correct. And I've been thinking a lot about this because, at least when it comes to education, sometimes the world changes. And that's exactly what's happened. Right now, everyone has a smartphone. And now with the 4 billion people who have had access to the internet, and many of those people with smartphones, all of them connected to other humans, that is a serious way that the world has changed. And when the world changes, it does sometimes invalidate the Lindy effect.
But here's where I think it's good. Our instinct is to do things that are geared toward the future. So we're always reading and exploring and wanting to know and research the last new thing. But we also need to make sure that the content and the approaches or the methods that we're betting on or that we're exploring are still relevant both today and at some well-defined point in the past. So as it turns out, a lot of the things that you and I talk about and our beliefs about education come from ideas that have actually been around for many, many, many years. Ideas that could be considered Lindy. And today we're going to be covering five of them. The first one is learning by doing and mimicking. The Socratic method, teaching as entertainment, micro schools with mixed age groups, and the teacher's role in the learning process. So according to the Lindy effect, the fact that these ideas have been around for so many years is a good predictor that they will continue to be around for years to come. But before we start, David, what is your show and tell item for today?
So I brought a book, and I brought this book because for two reasons. The first one is that it is the book about Edward Snowden. It's called Permanent Record. And I saw it on bookshelves for the first time probably 5 years ago. And I try really hard not to read new books because actually my book club is called the Lindy Literary Society. And the reason that we call it that is because we let time be the judge of quality, and we only read books that are Lindy. So we've been reading a lot of old books. That's basically all we do. We read books that were usually written between like 1910 and 1990. But this book is a little bit newer than that, and I let time and a bunch of friends recommend it to me before I decided to read it. But also, we're going to be talking about the Socratic method. And I just moved to this house and I'm living with five friends. And one is super into privacy and security. And so we decided that we would all read the book together. And we are going to, in a very Socratic way, work through the ideas here. So we're going to read the book and then learn through conversation, which is one of the things that Socrates recommended in his philosophy of education. What did you bring?
Amazing. David, I also brought a book. I brought a book called The One World Schoolhouse by Salman Khan, who is the founder of the Khan Academy.
Khan Academy.
Yep, Khan Academy. And very much like you, the reason why I brought this for show and tell for the Lindy Effect is because one of the things we're going to be talking about are micro schools. And micro schools are actually like the updated version of the one-room schoolhouses, which were around since the 18th century. So we're going to be talking about this. I love this book, and he covers how we should go back to this idea of teaching in this micro school, one-room schoolhouse model. So I'll leave it there so that we can talk about it later, but that's my show and tell for today. And this actually transitions to this idea that, as we mentioned earlier, in this talk, a way to go forward is to return to certain old models or methods or approaches that have been around for a long time, but that maybe have been cast aside in the name of progress, which is what we tend to see in education. So the first one being learning by doing. And we always talk about how kids learn best when they're actively engaged, when they're exploring, when they're creating and experimenting and trying things out, rather than when they're sitting passively in a room, just listening to a lecture and trying to memorize facts. And this idea of learning by doing actually dates back to the pre-literate hunter-gatherer societies. So that was 2 million years ago, where parents taught their kids the basic survival skills, just like animals do, by practicing them themselves. And whenever they could, they would insert an element of play into the process. This was mainly the way that people learned back then. But then, as humans, human language developed, societies start to grow more complex and more specialized. And suddenly a need to teach more specific skills and knowledge that went beyond the abilities of parents to teach them by themselves. So this gave rise to the apprentice system, which dates back to the Middle Ages. And it was actually the first time in history that the main responsibility of education was shifted from the parents to an outsider. So the idea that we know today that the masters are the ones who taught and ruled the teacher, and that the students are the one who submitted and learned, was very common back then. But the manner of learning was not the passive absorption that we see today in conventional classrooms. Apprenticeships back then were based on active learning and learning by doing, and the kid would observe someone that they admired or that was very talented in a skill specifically and mimicked all the techniques and strategies of the master. So if you think about it, today's like doctoral programs are really apprenticeships, where you have like the PhD candidate or a junior researcher learning alongside a professor. Same with medical residency programs, where you also, they're really apprenticeships, or, you know, teaching programs like the ones that I did. I was really doing an apprenticeship program for a long time. So although this idea of learning by doing and apprenticeships have been mostly cast aside by conventional schools, we still see them in Montessori approaches, or as we're going to talk in a moment, some MBA schools. And I believe that it's coming back. And if you think about it, our ideas that are so old and that still makes sense and still work. So I am betting on kids probably starting to go back to learning by doing, and also maybe even joining apprenticeship programs or trade schools or boot camps where they're going to pick maybe a specialization or something that they want to really learn about from someone that they really admire and then gain skills on that from an earlier age. That's one of my predictions based on this Lindy idea. Thoughts?
I'm going to take this in the most surprising direction. So there's this country song called Watching You by Rodney Atkins, and it's all about how boys mirror their fathers and how they look up to their parents. And so this is the chorus. He said, "I've been watching you, Dad. Ain't that cool? I'm your buckaroo. I want to be like you and eat all my food and grow as tall as you are." And I think that that line, as poorly as I sang it, is just a beautiful illustration and of how people just copy others. And even the root of ape, which is what humans are, shares the root with the word imitate. And humans are imitative creatures. That's the best way that we learn. And, you know, it's funny, I've been living with my family for the past many months until recently. And one of the things that they always said was, you know, you couldn't pay attention in class, but you were so good at just copying other people and sort of mirroring them. And I used to mirror people's baseball stances and their swings and golf swings too, and imitations. And I think that that's a lot of the way that we learn. We copy other people directly, and then we figure out What is it that we like about copying them? What is it that we don't like? And then through that, by actually trying on other personalities, we then discover who we are. You know, this is why a high schooler in America will start off at like buying clothes at Hot Topic and then go to Abercrombie and Fitch and then go to Vineyard Vines. And like if you pulled a collection of a kid's wardrobe, it's all over the place. And what we're doing is we're imitating celebrities and different models and different friends that we have. And so much of what we learn about who we are and about the world just comes from looking at others and just saying, hey, I kind of like that person. I want to be more like that.
Because in school, it's pretty stigmatized. Like copying or imitating is considered something wrong. They try to tell you, you know, don't do that. But at the same time, that's what students are doing. They're mimicking the teacher. But whenever you try to grab somebody's work and then try to replicate it and add your own, then that's considered something wrong. And recently I've been listening and hearing different people talk and realize that that's one of the best ways to learn, right? By mimicking and by, like you said, finding someone that you admire that does something really well, then trying it out, following that person's steps, but then injecting your own personality and finding your way along the way. So we talked about the hunter-gatherers and learning by doing. Then we transitioned into apprenticeships, which was basically getting those hard skills and learning so that you could actually do a job or specific things. And then around the 5th and 4th century BC came the model of the classical Greek academy, based on this idea that men actually desire knowledge, so not just practical skills. And this idea of learning just for the sake of learning, not necessarily to work at something. And we start to see the rise of schools of the school of Socrates. Did I say it correctly?
Yes.
Good. Who believe that people seek and gain deeper understanding of concepts through thoughtful dialogue rather than memorizing information that has been provided to them. Something that we talk about a lot, right? And he came up with the Socratic method. And this method involved not conveying knowledge, but rather asking questions and questions until students arrived to their own understanding or answers about the world. So it was, for the first time, a two-way method of communication, and it was active learning. And I want you to talk about this in a moment. Socrates wanted to make sure that his students were involved at all times. And that's why he continued asking questions rather than just giving a lecture. He said that just giving lectures doesn't engage the audience, which, again, another timeless idea that we often reference to. And I know that you had some thoughts about this active way of learning.
Yeah, there's a quote that I like from Mortimer Adler, and he says, "A lecture has been described as the process whereby the notes of the teacher become the notes of the student without passing through the mind of either." And it's really powerful because, you know, if you talk to college students about how they write their papers, my sister said straight up, it just, you got a better grade if you just parroted what the teacher said. And what, so I was at a, took a class at Columbia, and that's what everyone did, including me, when I got in the school environment. You just write down what the teacher says word for word, and then you basically just sort of regurgitate that back to the teacher. And there is an idea from Plato's Symposium that I think hits at a lot of the ways that we do learning wrong. We have this idea that learning, that people are like computers, where if you just give people information, like, I have a friend who uses this term, like, you download information from somebody. But, like, that's just not how learning works. You can't just download someone's ideas. And this is one of the things that once you get into marketing that you really begin to learn, because you see empirical proof of this. People need to see an idea over and over and over again before they really understand that idea and before they're willing to buy a product. How many Coca-Cola advertisements have you seen in your life? Each one actually builds the brand recognition. And knowledge isn't binary. It's not like you don't know something and then you know something. Like, there's an element of truth in that. But if you've ever become an expert on an idea or really begin to understand something, you'll realize that there's all of these stages. Like, you learn the thing and you understand it intellectually, and then you understand it experientially, and then you understand it through action, and then you understand it by teaching others. And there's all these modalities of the way knowledge is constructed. And you can't just pretend like your brain is a bucket and go all the information in, and then it just works out.
Some MBAs use this approach, the Socratic method approach. And for example, HBS has the case study. And I had the opportunity to go to several classes, and I loved the engagement, how everyone was on their toes because they could be called at any second. The teacher came in with an idea of what they were going to be discussing. But really, the questions and the comments that came up in the class and in the audience were what was driving the lesson. So again, this idea of Socrates arrived to the answers through discussion and thinking and grappling through ideas, and he kept them on their toes, which is something that we're going to talk about a little bit later. But it's one of the things that Socrates really believed in. He said, it's not forcing people to learn. That doesn't work. It's about engaging them and making them want to learn, which, again, a timeless idea. We talk about this a lot, and it dates back to the 5th and 4th century BC, right? So these ideas just keep coming back. And of course, this model was very elitist, especially back then. Like, not a lot of people could afford just hanging around Socrates and just talking about the good and the true. Most of the people needed to harvest their crops or weave the textiles. But it's the principles that we're talking about here, like the different things in the Socratic method that really resemble the things that we talk about. And this kind of leads me to the next idea, which is teaching and entertainment. And it's very much related to what we just talked about. We talk a lot about how the crucial test of education, if you want to put it that way, is to teach kids how to learn and to lead them to want to learn, to nurture their curiosity and to encourage wonder and just to give them the tools and the confidence to be able to find the answers in the future when they don't have anyone around. And for this kind of learning to be possible, it has to be appealing, and we need to sell the idea of learning. And that is not common in today's conventional systems. The teachers just kind of impose it. But for Socrates, again, the most important order of business was to engage the person. So he did not believe in forcing it. He believed in engaging, and he used different ways of doing it. The cold calling, he said that just by using a bit of sarcasm and irony and just calling people randomly without them being known that they were going to be called, that kept them on their toes. And just the discussions were so rich that everyone just wanted to learn more because they had the opportunity to participate in the learning. Also, in the second half of the 5th century BC, the Sophists, which were also teachers, but unlike Socrates, they were paid and they had like a different way of doing things, but they also used tools of philosophy and rhetoric to entertain, impress, and persuade the audience. That was kind of the goal. So it also blew my mind how that way back then, so many centuries ago, that was the main purpose, right? To entertain, to persuade the audience, and to engage them. And that's kind of what we advocate nowadays that educators should be doing.
I was reminded of what I could say now are two different models of education, and you could call them the Socratic method of entertainment and persuading people to enroll in what's being discussed. And enrollment isn't just signing up for something. It's bringing your heart as well as your body to an experience. And then on the other side, we have the B.F. Skinner model. And what Skinner did, or like a Pavlov model, where what you're doing is you're sort of gaming human psychology, saying, okay, we've studied certain things on rats and cats, and we see that certain things work. Now let's apply that to humans. And I was talking to a friend last week, and she went to Brown, and Brown doesn't have grades. And you can also create your own classes if you can get a teacher to support you. And what we ultimately concluded is that the Skinner and Pavlovian model basically reduces the variance while capping the upside of an educational experience. So what you get of the benefit is you get everyone has an incentive to get good grades, and if you don't pay attention, you will be punished. That is how we think of a lot of school. But the flip side of this, and this is the more Socratic Brown methodology, is there's no grades. But we are going to design an experience where you are here because you want to learn, because you love to learn, and for no other reason. And once again, it increases the variance. There's no doubt that there is a number of people in society who, given that, I mean, me for the first 20 years of my life would say, well, no point of going to class today then. That's who I was. And now that I am a very curious learner and have built up those muscles, that sounds great. It is the very fact that there is no outcome that makes things wonderful for me when I'm learning. And we have talked a lot about this as we've thought about Rite of Passage. We had a suggestion from an MBA friend last week that you should work to add a credential for Rite of Passage. And I refuse. I don't want students who are doing anything for the credential. I don't want to follow a Pavlovian or Skinner model. I want enrollment and then for people to learn for the joy of learning. And I am willing to accept the trade-offs of that.
I think that now there's so many options out there that people are starting to migrate to what they're interested in or what calls their attention. So for example, when you said that you started to work on those muscles, no one was forcing you to do things anymore. So you started to go in the direction of things that called your attention, that caught your interest, and you're like, oh, this sounds interesting to me. So I feel like that there's a big opportunity in the education space to work on that and to have all these alternatives that make it appealing for kids to go there and to say, I really want to learn with this teacher. I really want to do this.
Yeah, you know, the problem with the word education is it's a top-down process. And sometimes top-down is really good. But it is the teacher directing the experience for the student.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, there are moments in life where that is absolutely beneficial. Like, I'm going to get my pilot's license. And I want my flying coach to direct the experience for me and to map it out. Because there's serious danger, and it'll save me a lot of time. But that works because I've enrolled in that experience. But if you have education as top-down, you have learning as bottom-up. And Steve Jobs, in his famous Stanford commencement speech, says that the dots can only connect in retrospect, and somehow your intuition already knows who you want to become. And it's always worth considering when you get into a learning experience. Is this an education experience? Is it learning? But no matter what, our goal should be to have enrollment into the experience of knowledge creation, because then the top-down and the bottom-up systems, they both work better than if we just use that Pavlovian Skinner model of get good grades, otherwise you will be punished.
That is actually a great transition to one of our next points, which is the role of the educator. The role of the educator is extremely important in order for what you just said to happen. And for so many years, it's been the teacher's the authority and the teacher tells you what to do and this and that. And I thought that this was the Lindy idea. I thought that since this came from the Prussian model that dates 200 years ago, oh, that's the Lindy idea. Turns out that you go even further back to Socrates' times, and he would say over and over again, my role as the teacher is not to put knowledge into an empty mind, but to draw wisdom and clarity through questions and dialogue. And we talk about this a lot, that the teacher is now more of a facilitator, of a guide that has an idea of what the topics are going to be, but really lets the kids or the students be the ones who guide the discussion. And it's a more student-centered approach. And I also love how he talked that he was not the teacher. He was also a student at many, many times. And the students were the teachers. So it's a back and forth process. So it's this Lindy idea that the teacher is not the fountain of wisdom, but just a facilitator that provides the tools and the engagement and the opportunities for learning to happen. And this is something that we're seeing more and more in alternative approaches and in more progressive education like Montessori schools and Reggio Emilia schools and Waldorf schools, where you really see the kids doing most of the teaching and learning, and the teacher's just kind of there in the background to guide those questions and pose those questions.
Yeah, I've been thinking about the way that things that are Lindy come back into the future. And Marshall McLuhan, who's one of my biggest influences in his laws of media, this is what he focused on. So his whole idea was that he wasn't talking about media in terms of how we think of media, like major news corporations and stuff like that. He used media for technologies that are extensions of ourselves. So the wheel was media, cooking is media, like media sort of as a synonym of technology. And what he says is that once you get an acceleration in society, you always retrieve something from the past. So one of his best predictions was, for example, like we started off in sort of an oral culture where knowledge was passed down from generation to generation through the spoken word. So we would memorize things with aphorisms and with poems. That's why we had poems like the Odyssey or the Iliad. They compressed human knowledge into something that was memorable. And there used to be bards who would remember these the entire poem, and they could speak it from memory. So we started in this oral society. And then after the invention of writing and Gutenberg with the press, we became a textual society, basically. And what he saw was that what electric media was doing, television, the internet, was actually retrieving these oral patterns of thought. And he predicted a lot of the tribalism that would come into the future, the sort of instantaneous speed of thought, the lack of deliberation in society, and a whole multitude of effects that have to do with how we perceive the world. And he predicted that because he saw that we were moving through the textual time and actually retrieving an oral history from the past, and use that idea, this idea of going into the future and bringing a Lindy idea into it, was one of his four laws of how technologies grow and mature, and use that to predict the future.
I love that. And I guess it takes us to our last idea that we're discussing today, which is very Lindy, and it's the one-room schoolhouses that I talked about at the beginning. So today, a very popular term that we keep hearing are micro schools. And it's become even more popular now that with the pandemic and everything, but it's essentially a form of homeschooling, but with a bigger crowd. So you have 5 to 10 kids and you learn with an adult that can be either a parent or a teacher. And it's a more flexible approach. And it's not 8 hours a day for 5 days a week. It's way more flexible. The kids can be more self-paced. And one of the biggest ideas here is the mixed age group. When you think about it, there's nothing natural about segregating kids by age. That's not how families work. It is not what the world looks like. And it really runs counter to what kids have learned and the way they've socialized for most of human history, as we've talked about since the hunter-gatherers, right? You didn't have this age segregation. That's fairly a new idea. So for this reason, I really believe that the school of the future is going to be more like a micro school. And, you know, this updated version of the one-room schoolhouse, where you have kids with different ages without this like tyranny of the broadcast lecture and the one-size-fits-all curriculum. But instead of that, you have kids learning and teaching each other, enjoying the self-paced learning, having more one-to-one time with the teacher, having the flexibility to study maybe direct instruction for 2 hours, and then they can have more learning time, but in more unstructured ways. It has room for them to follow their curiosities, for them to actually build and do things with their hands instead of just consuming. So this whole idea really comes from an idea that's so old and that is coming back after 200 years. So I just think that micro schools or one-room schoolhouses are more closely related to what the world looks like outside the walls of a school. And therefore, it's a better way to prepare kids for the future. So this is one of those ideas that I'm really betting on, and that is very Lindy, according to what we're seeing.
It's weird that society is so age segregated. I sometimes wonder. It's a fun thought experiment. Like, if someone from the 17th century, the 14th century, came to today's society, what would they think is really weird? And of course, there's like the easy answers, smartphones and television and all that stuff. But that's not that very interesting. But like, what are the surprising ones? And I think that one of the surprising ones is age segregation. The way that you only really hang out with people your age, it's like, I remember being in kindergarten and looking at the third graders. Oh my God. They were all the way on the other side of campus, can't talk to them. And that's such a bizarre way that we've structured society. Like, it makes sense in a very industrial system because you just need to funnel the masses through these systems and you need to standardize everything. But even standardization itself, we've reached a lot of the limits of it and we don't need it anymore. And it just seems quite obvious to me that there are aspects of the what it means to be human and what it means to grow up in this world that you don't get if you're just with people your age the entire time.
Normal is what we're used to. So people, when they think of school and learning, everyone thinks of, well, most people think of grades and your people your same age. But if you think about it, it doesn't make a lot of sense because of the reasons that you just said. But also, it's a much better approach to have different ages. The older kids are teaching what they're learning to the younger kids, and the younger kids look up to the older kids and want to do things faster. And often you see that kids want to learn from other kids and from older kids, not so much from adults. So use that to your advantage and leverage that. You know, if the kid wants to learn from the older kid, then make that happen. So I really believe that we're going to go back to that idea of mixed age groups. I had the opportunity to work at a school in New York for a while as a student teacher that had this mixed age groups. And it was incredible, incredible to see. You had first through third graders in one classroom and then fourth and fifth graders in another classroom. And it was just beautiful, beautiful. There was a lot more engagement too. And I know you mentioned some of the benefits of the small group work and the one-on-one tutoring and the Bloom's Two Sigma problem. So maybe you want to wrap up with that?
Yeah, I'll wrap up with that. So I think that this is one of the really interesting open questions in the world of education, and this is the efficacy of one-on-one tutoring. So basically, there is a style of tutoring called mastery improvement, and mastery improvement with one-on-one tutoring led to, and this is a statistical term, a 2 sigma improvement in student performance, and the results were then replicated. And so if you take this idea seriously, you have to say, wait, that means that we are so far away from the optimal way of teaching, first of all. And second of all, it begs the question that may be one of the most important open questions in the field of education is, how can we replicate the one-on-one style of tutoring? What is it about tutoring that then leads to these outcomes? Is it the enrollment? Is it the fast feedback and ability to ask questions? I don't know. These are open questions that we as a field need to be thinking about and have top of mind so that we can scale the one-on-one tutoring and bring these results to a much wider set of people. So if I were to summarize everything that we talked about today, we started off with learning by doing and mimicking. And Anna talked about hunter-gatherers, apprenticeships, vocational schools. Then we moved on to the Socratic method. And we talked about active learning. Information isn't something that you can just download into your brain. You can't just pour ideas into your mind like you pour water into a bucket and it'll just fill up. No, you have to repeat ideas over and over again. And this is one of the things that places like Harvard Business School really understand. Then we spoke about how the sophists incorporated entertainment and persuasion into their communication style, and how we should be finding the synthesis between teaching and entertainment rather than seeing them as total opposites so that we can get enrollment. Then we spoke about the teacher's role in entertainment. So we went back to Socrates and we spoke about how the students can lead the discussion, they can lead the questioning in the classroom, and that teachers can sell the idea of learning rather than just enforcing it. And finally, we ended with micro schools inspired by Sal Khan in the One Room Schoolhouse, where throughout human history and in adolescence, kids have been with people of other age ranges, and now we only learn with people who are our same age. And we spoke about how these micro schools are going to be smaller, they're going to be more personal, maybe even more like Bloom's Two Sigma. Tutoring have that benefit, and finally, because they're smaller, because they're more community oriented, in order to be big enough, they're going to draw from a bunch of different age ranges.
So as it turns out, and as the Lindy effect explains, all these ideas that we have about the future of education and what works have actually been around for many, many, many years. So hopefully we can start to bring them back.
Woo, woo!